Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Coming up on 11 months of the Out of the Trenches podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and share on iTunes, Stitcher, and any of the sites where you download the podcast. It'll bring more listeners in. And also please share and promote on social media. Thank you.
My next guest is Dave Schmidow. He is the author of four books, has four kids, and has ran five marathons. He's also run two ultra marathons. He was a 2014 Principal of the Year, the 2018 College Educator of the Year, and is also a member of the Teach Better team. Dave is currently a professor of educational leadership at Central Michigan University. He is a former elementary school principal and middle school principal, assistant principal, coach, and teacher. His books can be found on Amazon, which are Making Assessment Work, Bold Humility, It's Like Riding a Bike, and Omnipotent. Is that how you
put it? Omniscient. Yeah, you were close. That was good.
He also hosts a blog and podcast, The Lasting Learning Podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell me a little bit of a time when you came out of the trenches.
Whew. Daily. Sometimes even just climbing out of bed feels like I'm climbing out of the trenches, to be honest with you. It's sometimes it's a struggle just to put your 2 feet on the ground and to come up swinging again. Yeah. But you know, right now, I think we could all resonate with the idea of digging in a little bit, putting ourselves in a trench. You know, I think back to trench warfare in World War I, where the troops would literally dig holes and stay there and see who could outlast the other one, shooting volleys across the landscape. Mm-hmm. And I feel like oftentimes as educators, that's where we find ourselves. We dig ourselves into our trenches and say, this is my position. This is where I'm going to stay. I'm not going to move. But sometimes we have to take that first step. We have to get out of the trench. Yeah. And honestly, that's where I live constantly right now, is trying to step out of that trench and take the shots as they come and then get back up the next day and try again.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like how you say that. Just getting up, trying again, you know, kind of the past is in the past, right? The next day can be a better day. And, you know, several of the past guests I've had have said, yeah, we are currently in the trench. You know, this is a tough situation, right? But we're doing our best. We're making the best of what we have. And, you know, having that positive mindset about it helps a lot. So
I guess let me clarify a little bit, because you say a positive mindset. I would argue I don't necessarily have a positive mindset. So let me put that into perspective. I feel the things that a lot of people are feeling right now. Yeah. I have the same fears that a lot of people are fearing right now. But I'm also a firm believer that a lot of what's happening right now in the world over the last 12, 16, 18 months is not necessarily bringing new problems to the surface for us to solve. Yeah. It's simply magnifying a lot of the things that were already going on and giving us the opportunity and the leverage to capitalize on those obstacles. I've made very clear over this past year, I'm using 2020 as this opportunity to bring new vision to myself and more clarity and more transparency about my life and my struggles than ever before. I've told stories recently to people about times where just 3 years ago, I found myself in the middle of the night standing on top of a bridge, wondering if I should take a step off. I found myself at a place where I have left jobs, moved across the state, moved out of my house. I've done a lot of things over the last few years to try to overcome and to renew myself and find who I am. And I'm using 2020, I'm using 2021, I'm using this time right now to find my own purpose, to find my own strength, to find my own fortitude and say, let's keep going. So it's not necessarily rainbows and sunshine. It's not necessarily optimism. It's just a commitment to take one step at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just going on that, what you were talking about of finding some way to get better, we both have in common that we like to run, and you've run a little bit longer distances than I have, but tell me about when you started running, and there's a story attached to that, and then kind of your experience in marathons and ultra marathons until, you know, they haven't been running for a little while.
Right.
You said you were doing a couple of virtuals as well.
Yeah. So I know the story that you're referring to that got me into officially running, mm-hmm. but there's actually a story before that. It goes back to when I was in ninth grade. So when I grew up, I was a military brat, went to 16 schools growing up and moving constantly. My parents were working hard and they could very rarely come to my sporting events. Mm-hmm. In ninth grade though, for some crazy reason, I decided to join the track team. I had never run before in my life. Wasn't very good. But a friend of mine's mom came to my track meet and she took a picture of me when I was out running the mile, which at that point was the longest race. And in the picture that she took, I'm all alone on the track. I mean, wind is just whipping through. Back then I had long hair and it looked like I was just hauling. And in the picture, it looked like I was dominating. The reality was I was still starting my fourth lap and everybody else had already finished their fourth lap. I was so far behind everybody that I decided at that moment I would never run again. I was going to crawl into a hole and I gave up the sport. I gave up the activity and said, running is not for me because of that one picture, that one moment that defined who I thought I was as a runner.
Yeah.
But we fast forward and the year was 2008. I was a middle school track coach blowing a whistle, telling other kids to run faster, to run harder. And I had a kid on my track team. His name was Justin. Justin was an amazing kid. Justin one day after practice challenged me to race him. And I said, no, I know I'll lose. I'm not going to race you. Yeah. I've got some pride I've got to maintain here. I've got to have some swagger. And if I go out there and lose to a middle school kid in a race, I'll never live that down. So instead we settled on a bet to run around the world. And the bet was the first person to run around the world, AKA 25,000 miles, would have to pay the other person $100. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I'll take that challenge, thinking I can go run in isolation, or thinking even better, he'll give up and he'll forget in a year or two.
Yeah.
Well, long story short, he didn't forget. He and I messaged back and forth for years, giving each other updates on our trip around the world. I've got a tattoo on my shoulder now with a globe and a man running around the world. Mm-hmm. And just last week, I got to the halfway point at 12,500 miles. And I'm on the second half of my journey around the world, hoping that I can eventually beat that former eighth grade student on this trip. I don't know if he's still running or not, but now I've made it so public to the world that I'm doing this, I got to keep going regardless.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great goal to have. And now you kind of know that it's going to take you, you know, about 11, 12 years to hit.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, and the older I get, the slower I go. So we'll see. We'll see.
Right. And, you know, you've mentioned that you've been in a couple of marathons and ultra marathons. Yeah. And what was your most recent race and what do you have coming up? Are you doing any virtual like ultra marathons or anything like that?
Yeah. 2020 was a year filled with a lot of virtual runs. Mm-hmm. The last big race that I did back in 2019, I ran both Boston and the Chicago marathons. Okay. Those are both just amazing events. Boston filled with tradition and so iconic. The weather is never ideal, so you never know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And then Chicago is just a huge party for 26.2 miles, an agonizingly painful party, but yeah, a party nonetheless. And then during 2020, so I did a few virtual, I did my own virtual ultra marathon back in the spring of 2020, mm-hmm. When I went down to Florida and just decided to see how far I could run along the beaches. Actually, was going to run a marathon, but then social media again caught me and I thought I would be able to get out of running a marathon. I hadn't fully trained for it. So threw out on social media, instead of running a marathon, I'll run a mile for every person that commits to running a mile with me.
Oh, okay.
Long story short, I ended up running an ultra marathon, ended up running 33 miles that day. Oh, wow. And ran up and down the beaches for, wow, my version of quarantine spring break. So that's what I've been up to recently.
Yeah, I've done about 5 miles on the beach when I've been on vacation, but it's a different type of running when you're on the sand.
That's the truth. That is the truth.
Yeah. And so, you know, you said the first marathon that you did, was that just shortly after that challenge, you know, in the late 2000s, or did it take you several years to work your way up to the marathon distance?
Yeah, it was in the late 2000s, actually. I ran the San Diego Rock and Roll Marathon. Mm-hmm. That was my first and my second marathon. And the first time I ran it, I honestly had no idea what I was doing. So I'll kind of geek out for those of you that are runners right now. you understand that not all runs are the same, that you're not, when you're going out and training, you're not supposed to just go out there and run 25 miles every single run for a training run, thinking you had to build up to running 26. Yeah. Well, I didn't know that. I thought, I'm a young guy, I'm in my 20s, I'll go out there, I'll run a marathon. So I had a training routine that had me out running 10, 15, 20 miles a day, every day. And race day was an absolute disaster. Finished the race, found myself at the finish line crying in the fetal position. Just an absolute mess. And yet again, another time in my life where I said, I'm giving this up. I retire. This is not the sport for me. But it's, I assume it's much like having a baby. A couple of days later, you forget about all the pain and agony. You say, oh, I want that again. And you do it all over again. So a couple of years later, I signed up again. And this time I actually read some books and figured out a proper training plan. Did not kill myself in the process and found myself hooked.
Yeah. And nutrition is also a big part of that. And, you know, I'm sure you, the first marathon, was there kind of a, you didn't really take any nutrition, or was there kind of a blood sugar low?
That's interesting you say that. Maybe I'll take that under advisement in the future. I'm one of those runners. I run so that I can eat. I run so that I can indulge in a couple of beers. And that first marathon, again, I was an absolute idiot. Didn't know what I was doing. There are people out there at mile 15 with beers saying, here, have this. I'm sure I'll have a beer. Mile 20. Here's a slice of pizza. You want that? Sure. I'll have that. I was a disaster. It was an absolute train wreck, but I made a lot of memories. I keep telling myself. So maybe in the future, I'll actually take that under advisement, monitor my carbs, my protein, all of that, but haven't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah. So you've made it through those recent marathons as well with just water. And,
just water, a little goo, some bananas, nothing special.
Yeah. Good. Well, since you do several runs that, you know, will take you out for an hour or two, do you often think of ideas for books or presentations during your runs, or when did those ideas come to you?
That's a great question. Honestly, so right now, as you mentioned in the intro, I've got four kids. So if I'm being completely honest, a lot of times I go for my runs because my four kids don't run. And it is an opportunity to get away. And when you go for an hour or two long run, it just, it gives me the time to just get away and be by myself and go where my mind takes me. There are some times where I'll put headphones on and just listen to a podcast or listen to some music and zone out. And there are other times where I have these little internal debates with myself. I tend to spend a lot of time on social media, and some people have said that I can poke the bear a little bit, and that's okay. I enjoy that. But then I have these little debates with myself where I am poking my own bear and I'm trying to decide, what do I really believe? And I have these philosophical discussions with myself about pedagogy, instruction, curriculum, religion, even sometimes. And I start to just play things out and try to really solidify, what is it that I believe, and what can I hang my hat on? And honestly, my books are all based off of presentations. Presentations are all based off of thoughts I've had on long runs. It doesn't go the other way around. So I get myself to a point where I'm convinced of something. So then I start sharing it publicly with other people, trying to experience their pushback, their debates, trying to figure out if I have an argument or whether or not I need to continue to refine my thoughts. And then the books grow from there.
Well, you told me on the pre-chat, recently you've been working with schools and districts and, you know, giving them some new teacher support on helping make assessments work. And I think you told me that you learned a lot from your missteps as a new leader, kind of working your way up early in your career to become a principal. And what are some of those things that you learn, and now that you reflect back on, of those missteps, and how you would have done that differently?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack in that question. Schmitto, tell me where you've messed up in life. How long do you want this podcast to be? So two things. First of all, you mentioned some of my more recent work, and we'll talk about that maybe later on. But what you're talking about right now specifically is this concept I call bold humility. Bold humility is basically my own journey. When I became a leader by title, by designation, a school administrator, my journey even to get to become a school administrator was ridiculous, to say the least. I guess I'll take you back there. After my first year of teaching, I already thought I had all the answers to everything. All you had to do was ask me and I could tell you how to fix every school and help every kid anywhere find success. I was so confident and so arrogant in my ways that I went out and got my master's degree. And after my third year of teaching, ended up going on 16 job interviews to try to become a school leader, become a school principal after 3 years of teaching. Didn't get a single call back and had no idea why. Decided then at that point that I was just going to go to law school just so I could prove to people that I was smart and then eventually get a job where I could start suing school districts that were making all the mistakes that obviously they were going to continue to make because they hadn't hired me. And just, I mean, it was just misstep after misstep after misstep. Had some amazing mentors that were brave enough to look me in the eye and call me out on my arrogance, call me out on the fact that I wasn't even a great teacher yet. There's no way I could be a great leader. Mm-hmm. Really humbled me. But I did eventually step into administration after spending a little bit more than 7 years in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But when I first became a leader, when I first became an administrator, I thought that I became an administrator because of how amazing I was in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I thought my charge, my responsibility was to create little versions of me. And I call them itty bitty schmitties. Mm-hmm. And I went around and I tried to make teachers into tiny replicas of what I was.
Yeah.
I felt like I have the answers. Obviously it worked in my classroom. Look, I was knighted and dubbed the leader of the school. So do things the way that I would do them. And I look back on that now and I think, oh my gosh, the embarrassment that I face of having had that response to leadership is, it's totally embarrassing. About 4.5 years ago or so, I started to have this awakening, these epiphanies that just started coming to me through mm-hmm. circumstances, through conversations, through reality checks. And I realized, wow, I missed the mark. Mm-hmm. And real leadership involves humility. I say often, if you get people to weigh in, you don't have to try to get them to buy in. Mm-hmm. And that's the message I try to preach now, is how to empower others to find strength in other people, how to get other people to weigh in so that you as a leader can put the right people around the table and that you don't have to always make all the decisions.
Yeah, no, it's so inspiring to hear how you're, you know, kind of unpacking just your arrogant attitude at the beginning, right? How you, there's probably, you know, several people out there that, you know, think after a few years of teaching, right, they know it all. And then you, again, making that mistake your first year as a principal and thinking everybody was going to be like you, right?
So, right.
You know, to realize that, no, it takes the humility that you wrote about in your book and how, you know, or you're learning from your staff, right? Everybody's working right. together to do best for kids.
Absolutely. I mean, it's ironic. The more answers you think you have, the fewer people will come to you with questions. So it's this bizarre dichotomy that it's not about being knowledgeable. It's more about being knowable. So you've got to get yourself in this place where you focus more on relationships and the people. I know that's cliche nowadays, mm-hmm. but it's so spot on true. People will work for people they like. Not necessarily people that they look at and think, oh, they're smart. They're the smartest person in the room. The smartest person in the room is often the loneliest person in the room. So just remember that.
Yeah, no, I've seen that happen before. So tell me a little bit about your current work in helping districts and helping them making assessment work. And, you know, are these districts that are using standards-based grading or just general wanting to learn more about just giving assessments formal formative and summative assessments now during hybrid and distance learning?
So first of all, it's always this awkward dance when it's, well, plug yourself, Schmitto, and I don't want to plug myself. So I'll give you the title, the full title, including the subtitle of the book, and then we can just talk through some of the work as opposed to the work that I do. We'll maybe have a conversation about the content. That the title of my most recent book is Making Assessment Work for Educators Who Hate Data But Love kids and love students. So, you know, we're in this accountability age of education. We've been in the accountability age now for 2 decades. We talk about data-informed decision-making. We talk about data-driven practices. And we have tons of conversation about data, but I'm also a firm believer, because I've lived in schools for 20 plus years now, that data is a four-letter word in the truest sense of the word to teachers. I jokingly say, but in all honesty, I could walk into a staff meeting in your school tomorrow and get a better reaction from teachers if I dropped the F-bomb than if I walked in and said, we're going to talk about data. If I say we're talking about data today, I'm going to get the eye rolls. I'm going to get people that pull out their phones and start texting. But if I drop the F-bomb, people are like engaged, like, ooh, this guy's intriguing. Data will turn people off in a heartbeat. I've literally walked into staff lounges and found data scrawled on bathroom stalls. Like it is literally the new swear word in schools. So a lot of the work that I do is helping demystify that and reminding people that it's not about numbers, that we don't take assessments or tests and label them as formative or summative and think that's going to create some sort of magic. It's just trying to help people make sense of how we measure evidence of student learning.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit in the pre-chat about standards-based grading, and there's a lot to unpack there. I had a experience about 6-7 years ago where I was in a district that had started just right before I was hired with the standards-based grading system, and I was teaching French, and the teachers over the summer had worked on making the curriculum work with the standards. There were 19 standards for level one, for example, right? And what we found out that first semester, especially when it came grading time, is that our Infinite Campus did not work with, totaling up the grades with the standards, right? And it was just a nightmare. And I remember working several hours over winter break trying to get the grades finalized. That district is still using standards-based grading, and I think it can be used appropriately. It's just, you know, that was a great learning curve for the district. What are your thoughts on, you know, standards? Is that something that should be used only at the secondary level? Can it be used at the elementary level? And, how can schools and districts better use standards-based grading now, especially with remote learning? And there's so many conversations around grading nowadays.
So pull out the hook whenever you're ready, or feel free to edit out this because I might just go off here. The situation you just presented to me fascinates me, intrigues me, infuriates me, gives me all the feels all the same time. What you just described as a building or a school that was using standards, using standards-based instruction, I think were your words, but really the curriculum was the framework.
Yeah.
The curriculum was the base. So what your school was using was a curriculum-based instruction, not a standards-based instruction. That's like me saying, I have a broccoli-based diet. I don't have a broccoli-based diet. My diet is based off of brownies and beer, and I throw in some broccoli from time to time. Yeah. There's a big difference between having a broccoli-based diet and throwing in some broccoli. So a standards-based classroom, a standards-based school is one where you start with the standards. And there's a lot of missteps that I think a lot of schools take. And I think there are a lot of schools out there that think that they're doing standards-based grading or standards-based instruction, and they've taken those first steps. Mm-hmm. But that's as far as they've gotten. There are a lot of people that will have an administrator or a school leader that will go to a conference. They'll hear somebody like me or Rick Warmly or Wiggins or Stiggins or somebody else that will start preaching about standards-based grading. They'll come back to their school and think, okay, I heard this guy talk for an hour. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And they just drop it in teachers' laps, or they take the next step and say, but I'm going to help you. We'll create these curriculum guides, these pacing mm-hmm. guides, these curriculum apps. We'll lay it all out for you. And everything will be aligned to the standards. But you and I both know it doesn't work for a lot of reasons. The first reason it doesn't work, I'll just give you some numbers to hedge the last part of your question. Does this work for all grade levels? Yeah. I'll use sixth grade because it's right in the middle. A real statistic, if you were to base it off of the Common Core, which every state has some variation of Common Core, whether or not your state has changed it based off of politics or not, mm-hmm. it's based off of Common Core language.
Yeah.
If we were to use Common Core, there are 257 standards for a sixth grade student to learn, just focusing on the four core subjects of math, science, social studies, and language arts. Mm. 257 for 1 year in sixth grade. But because we believe in well-rounded students, if we were to throw in art, music, and PE, the three most popular electives, that number goes to 1431.
Wow.
Okay, so just conceptualize it. Let's just go back to the 257.
Yeah.
So the average school year is 180 days.
Yeah.
That means that doesn't include COVID days. It doesn't include snow days. It doesn't include mm-hmm. teacher sick days or student sick days. If a student is there for 180 days, the teacher's there for 180 days. Mm-hmm. 257 standards means a student is mastering a standard every 0.7 days. It does not happen.
Yeah.
And when I say mastering a standard, I'm not saying covering a standard.
Yeah.
Because if the expectation is teachers cover the standards, your first day of school, I'm going to tell you, pull out the standards and read them to your kids and you are done. That's not the expectation. The expectation is for students to learn them and to master them. We cannot teach 257 standards in a 180-day school year. So that's the first struggle that we come up against, is we simply say, We're teaching the standards.
Yeah.
And we'll come up with this pacing guide that will help us cover all the standards. But you and I both know after 2 weeks, you're in this pacing guide. And now at the end of 2 weeks, it's like this choose your own adventure book where you've got 15 kids that have mastered it, 15 kids that aren't anywhere close, 5 kids that are kind of close. And now you have no idea where to go. So what do you do? The pacing guide becomes a roadmap and you say, I'm just going to move on. Yeah. And now you've done the exact same thing you've always done, mm-hmm. but you're following a map and you're saying it's aligned to the standards, but it's not aligned to standards. You're not meeting the depth. You're not meeting the endurance, which is why across America today, even though we're in the standards-based era, this accountability age, we are not seeing an uptick in accountability scores in any state, anywhere, in any subject area, because we're doing the same things we've always done, just with different labels and different tricks without changing our mindsets and our principles.
Yeah. You know, and I think, like you said, it's, you know, you can do all the front loading work, right, with your team and put all these maps together and say, you know, we're going to cover these units. Like I did every beginning of every unit, I would say to the kids, these are the standards. These are the learning targets for these standards. And then every assignment would have different standards assigned to it. But, you know, like you said, if it's tied to a curriculum, is it truly standards based?
Yeah, right? It's spot on. So I'll take it a step further for you, if that's okay. There's a big difference between standards-based grading and standards-based instruction as well. I think oftentimes with standards-based grading, people think they continue to teach the way they've always taught, and they teach to assess. An assessment comes at the end. The big mindset shift that I try to teach people is that assessment should lead to instruction, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And if that's what standards-based instruction is all about, getting kids to master standards, you need to know where they are so you can know where they need to go. So your assessment leads to instruction. And this is a big mindset shift that I'm going to poke the bear and I'm going to infuriate a lot of curriculum directors and people out there that have given guidelines and mandates, but whatever, message me. I'll tell you how to contact me when we're done. Another example of people trying to take the quick fix.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this loud and I'll say this as poignantly as I can. If your school or district has two grading categories, one that is called formative and one that is called summative, you are not a standards-based school, not a standards-based school. Okay. And I'm going to say that very clearly because I think what happens is a lot of schools say, I understand standards-based grading. I need to have these formative practice assignments and these summative ones that count. So I'm standards-based, but it's actually the exact opposite. And here's why. First of all, there's not a shred of research that says formative and summative assessments do anything for kids. That's number one. The research says using assessments formatively and summatively, the L-Y, changing those to adverbs, is what the research says, formatively and summatively. What ends up happening in schools is we say, we're going to give students these formative assignments, which aren't going to be worth a lot of points. They're going to be a small part of a student's grade, but they're formative, meaning me as the teacher, I'm going to be using this to inform my instruction, hence formative. I'll find out what the kid knows. But what we've inherently just said is that we're going to use assignments that we just said aren't very good, that don't tell us a whole lot, to drive our instruction. And at the opposite end, we've got these summative assessments that we're going to give to kids because they're high quality, they're valid, they're reliable, but they're summative in the way that we define them, meaning they come at the end of it all. So I can't do anything with that instruction. I can't do anything with that assessment data to drive instruction forward. True standards-based classrooms treat all evidence as good evidence, just like a lawyer does when presenting a case. We don't go out looking for the smoking gun. We try to present the case of what does all of the evidence show. We use that to plan our instruction and to measure progress along the way.
No, I really like how you say that. You know, measure progress along the way and using those assessments, you know, if they're not good, like if you're tied to a curriculum that, you know, has a lot of holes in it or can be improved, then yeah, you're not really finding out how kids are doing along the way, right? And you know, that is kind of a wake up call, like you said, having those, and that's something we used in the grade book, right? It's formative and summative assessments, right? It was 20% formative and 80% summative.
So, right.
Let's move a little bit to kind of your journey. In the past couple of years, you've moved from being an elementary school principal to a college professor. And what made you make that move? And what do you miss not being in the K-12 setting?
Yeah, so there's a couple of pieces in between that move. So when I first moved into leadership, I did the athletic director, assistant principal thing and middle school principal. Then I had the opportunity after being a middle school principal to move to Florida. I live in Michigan now and move to Florida and become a turnaround principal at a high poverty, high needs school, which completely transformed my mindsets and the way that I thought about kids and teaching and learning. Amazing experience. But then I got another opportunity to come back to Michigan to serve as an assistant superintendent, curriculum mm-hmm. instruction. And right now, like you just mentioned, I have the opportunity to work as a college professor. To be quite honest, what prompted me to make that shift was that the college professor gig, I want to put this out here for people, is not a promotion. Mm-hmm. I took a 40% pay cut to make this transition, a 40% pay cut. You work in isolation, you work by yourself, there's no collegiality, mm-hmm. Everything is sort of competitive. It's a different space. Mm-hmm. But for me, it worked because it allowed me flexibility. Because yeah. my real passions involve doing the things that we're doing right now, talking about these sorts of things. And when I had the 9-to-5 day job, which we all know in education, there's no such thing as a 9-to-5 day job. It's a 9-to-9 day job. Yeah. Trying to find times to help on a greater scale, helping other schools and other districts, it became cumbersome, especially with 4 kids at home and travel and speaking. It got hard. So doing college professor work allows me a little bit more flexibility. I can teach my classes right now. Every class I teach is fully online. Mm-hmm. And that was actually the arrangement prior to COVID. And then I do research, which is already something I love. I get paid for that. I get benefits, the whole kit and caboodle, but I also get to work with people all across the country and really all around the world right now. Mm-hmm. So it comes with the benefit of flexibility, autonomy, but I don't want people to think, oh, I want to go out and become a college professor because of this status. There is no status there. I assure you, there is no status there.
So what are you currently researching?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've got two big driving interests. Mm-hmm. The first interest, it's built off of what I did my dissertation on about a decade ago, and it continues to fascinate me. It's the idea of the assistant principalship mm-hmm. and why the assistant principalship is the only stepping stone position in education. It's mm-hmm. literally the only position, if you think about education, that nobody aspires, or very few people aspire mm-hmm. to get that job and keep that job. Yeah. The average tenure for an assistant principal is less than 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of interest around that, the motivation, what that turnover does to school culture and climate, especially at the secondary level when assistant principals are climate and culture creators and drivers. So that fascinates me. Then there's this other aspect where I think this one will probably intrigue you as a podcaster. I'm doing a lot of research right now on the role social media has on professional learning. Okay. Professional learning, professional development has evolved dramatically, especially during the pandemic and COVID. And there are a lot of educators out there turning to Facebook and Twitter and Voxer and podcasts now to fill themselves through for their professional learning. It's no longer the traditional keynote presentation on the first day of school, bringing in some outside consultants, doing small breakout sessions. Social media has turned into the new go-to marketplace. So yeah. I'm doing some research on that, how that has evolved, how it's developing, and if it's actually making an impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be great to hear about when you finish that research. And, you know, like you said, especially in the past 9 months with the pandemic and a lot of people turning to that. And I even have done the PD for a few conferences recently on, you know, finding your own niche in PD and, you know, having PD that works for you and, you know, not the set thing that the school or district provides, but, you know, encouraging those who participated in the sessions to, you know, read some books of things that I've done, you know, during the pandemic with book clubs and those type of things, but also, you know, podcasts that I would suggest, not only my own, but some others, right? And then also, you know, just who you can follow on Twitter. Like, you know, there's a lot of educators that have gone on social media recently, but there's still a lot that aren't using that as a medium and a tool. I really found that interesting also with the AP position, you know, the turnover, like you said, if you're setting the climate and culture, if you're responsible for a lot of the discipline, you know, the attendance as well, you know, that can lead to people wanting to turn over. And I've listened a lot to Principal Caffelli on, you know, his talk about the assistant principal job and how, you know, he doesn't want that to be the disciplinarian, right? And what are your thoughts kind of on that AP role and what they should be doing instead of being a disciplinarian? And, you know, is an AP role sort of the role that some people would be good in for, you know, 10 plus years, like a career AP?
That's a loaded question. So I'll answer it objectively and subjectively. Objectively, what the research shows us is that most assistant principals enter that because they have a dream of eventually being a principal.
Yeah.
They see that as the stepping stone to get to their ultimate destination. Yeah. Very few assistant principals step into it thinking before they even start the job, this is something I want to do. Mm-hmm. Subjectively, I think it could be an intriguing job for some people. Mm-hmm. If I'm a firm believer in a concept known as the realistic job preview. Mm-hmm. So when you go in for a job interview, for example, having the person across the table interviewing you saying, before you answer a single question, let me truly explain to you what this job looks like, feels like, sounds like, what a day-to-day look is all about before we even entertain this interview. So you know what the job is. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer that most assistant principals conceptually understand that they'll probably have to do some discipline. They'll probably have to make some phone calls to parents, mm-hmm. But they don't understand what the job really entails.
Yeah.
I think if we made that explicit and we said that this was the job, there would be a lot of people that would say, I'm actually really good at that. Mm-hmm. I don't have any desire to ever become a principal, but what you just described to me is something that I could do. Mm-hmm. The problem is when we give assistant principals a lot of those tasks, but then we also add on to that a lot of decision-making criteria, a lot of leadership decision-making that's necessary. And this expectation of observation, teacher growth, evaluation, a lot of other things, it gets cumbersome.
Yeah.
What I've seen is most assistant principalships are not a training ground for the principalship at all. Mm-hmm. They're not, with the exception of the fact that you're no longer in the classroom and staff now looks at you in a different way. Yeah. Other than that, very few tasks that assistant principals are really fully in charge of mirror and mimic the expectations for principals in most schools. Mm-hmm. So if we could just truly carve out what the job description is and make that transparent, I think we'd see a lot more success. We'd see a lot less turnover. We'd see longer tenures and we'd see happier APs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're right. And I think it depends on the school as well, like how you're going to carve that out and what type of tasks you're going to give them. But like you said, you know, there are a lot of things that maybe weren't part of the job that they are asked to do, or if they end up going into a principalship, sometimes after a year or two of being an AP, they aren't prepared for that principal role because they didn't get some of that hands-on experience, right?
That's absolutely right.
So yeah, I definitely would be interested in reading that research as well in the future. Well, it's been great to talk to you about different things that you've been working on and some of your interests. And out of everything that we've talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
So I'll probably throw out something that might not resonate based off of what we talked about. It might seem like I do a lot of different things, mm-hmm. but I work really hard to try to make sure that everything in my life is aligned. It's all purposeful. It's all about measuring my own progress and taking one step forward each day. Mm-hmm. So I guess the thing that I would resonate on people is to focus on your focus and make that your priority, mm-hmm. and then measure your growth on that, not compared to anybody else, not compared to somebody that you see, somebody that you hear, somebody that you watch, somebody that you listen to. Look yourself in the mirror, figure out who you are, where you want to go, and then measure your growth on your own journey, not compared to anybody else.
Great. Yeah. Those are great words to end by. And, you know, think of like, what's your journey? And that's also that's a kind of the theme of an article that I'm going to be reading in about a month. So kind of running the race and you know, your goal might be maybe constantly moving, but yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, it was great chatting with you today. Where can people find you online?
Yeah. If people can figure out how to spell my last name, then they can find me everywhere. My last name is Schmitto, S-C-H-M-I-T-T-O-U. So I'm at Dave Schmitto on Twitter. I'm at Dave Schmitto on Instagram. I'll even throw my phone number out there. Shoot, I need friends. Text me, call me 734-377-3457. But if you can find Schmitto, schmitto.net is my website. Literally Schmitto. If you can type that in, you'll find me.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
Absolutely. Thank you.